All right, hi everybody, and welcome to lecture 55 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high. We're going to keep going with the Greco-Persian War here, of course. Before we dive into that, however, I have a recommendation for you for an activity for tonight, if you need one. And even if you don't. So, this is what I'm going to do tonight, and it would be a great idea for you to try to do the same. So, tonight in theaters across the country, there's a showing of this movie called Florence and the Uffizi Gallery. And so, it's going to be a big screen HD presentation of the city of Florence, and in particular the Uffizi Gallery is where Michelangelo's David is located, the greatest sculpture of all time, and along with other wonders of the Renaissance. So if you don't have a chance to go to Florence, and most of us don't frequently do, or I don't know if I said that right, but, you know, we don't usually, most of us don't have many opportunities to go on trips around the world and see wonders like this. This is an amazing chance, I think, because we normally look at art on the small screen in reproductions here, and there's no way for you to get to understand the grandeur of it in this particular setting. We can analyze it intellectually, we can enjoy it in a variety of ways, but there's no way to experience the beauty of it in this setting. Now, you always want the best that you can do always is to go see the thing in itself, the reality of it, in front of it, in person. But if I'd imagine the possibility that there's an even better way, this would be it, which is to see it on the big screen. To see it up close and in HD in a movie theater, I think I'm really looking forward to this, because you're going to see the greatest art ever produced in some regards, some of the greatest art ever produced, and you're going to see it just in spectacular form. So I'm really thrilled. I'm really looking forward to this. So it's on tonight. Unfortunately, it's only a one-night event, so they really are putting the pressure on. This company, Fathom Events, is a really cool company, and they put on things like operas and stuff like that, which I really enjoy. Not everybody enjoys the music of operas, but I do. So I love what they do, and I'm excited by the fact that they're doing this. I'm hoping that they will do others as well, similar types of things if they can in the future. But anyway, all right, that's enough of that. It's on tonight. If you want to see a movie and substitute whatever normal activities you have on a Wednesday evening, this is your best choice, guaranteed. So now let's get back to the birth of the Greco-Roman civilization that's going to be reborn here in the Renaissance. Let's go back to Greece. Let's look at the Persian Empire bearing down on Greece and how finally things are going to turn. Because so far, even though it hasn't been all that scary, you know, like Expedition 1 failed, Expedition 2 was defeated at Marathon. Well, now we're in Persian Expedition 3. It doesn't look all that scary, but it is still the biggest army ever assembled, and it is making its way down, and it has passed this one barrier that the Spartans put into place at Thermopylae. So here it comes down, and we have, this is one of those two great defeats, as I like to call them. Hard to read sometimes, so I'm putting it in a brighter yellow. Maybe that'll be easier for you guys. So there is one great defeat at Thermopylae. And meanwhile, the Persian fleet is shadowing this advance and on its own course. And then we have this other Great Defeat, as I call it. And I prefer the I prefer a different spelling here. I use Artemisium, which might be kind of a Latin spelling, but anyway. So those are the two great defeats of the Greeks in the Greco-Persian Wars. And like I said yesterday, the definition of a great defeat is, well, it is a defeat, but how can it be great? What makes it, in its own sort of way, a positive outcome? Abby? Hold on a sec. Got tangled up there. Go ahead.
If it caused a lot of damage for one of the side that defeated the other side to defeat them, then it's kind of... They're sitting there saying, we have all these people that we've lost, we're diminished, and the people who have been defeated aren't as bad off, and they're kind of saying, well, they've got all these people
that is,
killed, and they're diminished, and we're in a better place now.
That is true. So what is the ultimate outcome, though? All of that being true, what does that kind of defeat do in the war? Even though it's a defeat in a battle, this is the key. You're missing the kind of the overarching idea here. You've got the details. Theo? Rosie? Go ahead.
It's a defeat that's advantageous to losers.
Yeah, okay. Well, or it might not even, I guess that's kind of also what Abby is saying. And here's the way that I would phrase it. So I would phrase it as, it's a defeat in a battle that contributes to victory in the war. Okay, right? When you are fighting a war, it's not the battles that count. I mean, certainly you don't want to lose battles, but it is possible to win battles and lose a war. And it's one of the more interesting examples of that would be the Hundred Years' War in European history. For those of you who want to just hearken back to that context for a moment, it was once said by a historian, cleverly, so I don't get credit for the line, but some historian once said of the Hundred Years' War, the English won all the battles but lost the war. And that's pretty close to being true. Not quite, not all the battles, and I'm probably misquoting. So it's good I'm not attributing this to anybody in particular. But something was said to that effect, that the English won all the major battles but lost the war. And in the Hundred Years' War, it was kind of almost the reverse of this. It was a small power trying to take over a large power. It was England trying to take over France. And they eventually just exhausted themselves. They just weren't capable of ruling a country five times its size. And so eventually, and it was over 100 years. It took even longer than that. And it's just not, they couldn't do it. So there's different scenarios that pop up in wars like this. And in this case, we have one overwhelmingly large enemy that is, you would think, would just swamp the smaller power. But when it wins certain battles, the cost is high. That's kind of what Abby was getting at. And in a certain sense, the defeat is advantageous to the losers, as Theo is saying. And one of the effects there can be that it demoralizes the winners, even though they won. And in this particular case, the advantage was to delay the advance and to allow the Greeks to prepare. Well, what should they do? What should they do? We already know that the Athenians have decided to build a navy. Well, how do you protect Athens with a navy, especially since the Persian army is coming? There's an interesting problem. And so, if you're the Greeks, who do you turn to for some sage advice, if you want, especially if you want some divine inspiration? Theo, Rosie.
The Oracle?
Mm-hmm. The Oracle of Delphi, right? Let's see if you can get some divine guidance, if the Greek gods will stoop to giving you a little bit of help here. And so here is the central passage of the cryptic answer that the oracle gave. The oracle always gave cryptic answers, kind of like you get, you know, on a fortune cookie or in, I don't want to be belittle the whole thing too much, but the point was that the oracle would never give straightforward advice because it wasn't that kind of advice. And so it was always kind of unclear. And if when we read this here, you'll see it could be interpreted different ways. And in a sense, with advice like this, you tend to find just what you're looking for, right? You hear what you want to hear. And so let's see what it is the oracle said and how would you interpret it? Far-seeing Zeus grants to thrice-born Athena a wooden wall. The only place not to be sacked, it will help you and your children. Do not wait for the great host coming from the continent, cavalry and foot soldiers. Turn your back and withdraw from the foe. Eventually, you will stand opposite them. O divine Salamis, you will destroy the sons of women. Okay, everybody know what to do? Zeus grants to thrice-born Athena. Why is Athena mentioned here? Zeus, as you probably know, is the father of the gods, right? He is the most powerful of the gods. And Athena is his daughter, but more than that, what's crucial? Why is Athena mentioned here? Because we're talking about what city? In particular, Abby?
We're talking about Athens here.
Yeah.
And Athens was the city of Athena.
Okay, right, exactly. Okay. And he's going to grant to Athens a wooden wall. So, what's that? The only place not to be sacked. Ooh, now that's pretty serious, right? Because the Persian army is coming, and what do they do with a city that has resisted their authority, their power? Well, they're going to destroy it. Does this mean that Athens will not be sacked because it has a wooden wall? Well, wait a minute. Notice, do not wait for the great host. Withdraw from the foe. That means retreat, right? Eventually you will stand opposite them. Okay, so the whole point here is, in broad strokes, is retreat. So, to fight another day. Okay, but where and when? And this is where we get the cryptic kind of a statement. O divine Salamis, you will destroy the sons of women. Now, I'll tell you what Salamis is in just a minute, because you probably don't know. But what do you make of this line? This is classic oracle here. Theo?
They'll kill a bunch of men, I suppose.
Yeah, okay, right? But who? Right? It doesn't say divine Zalmas will kill the sons of Persian women. Right? Or it could. What does this mean? Now, if you're Greek, you're going to interpret this, you know, you're going to try to take a positive spin, and you're going to say, well, what the oracle is saying is that we're going to win if we go to Salamis. Well, I'm sorry, I already assumed something here, the idea of going to Salamis. So let me just show you why that would be the interpretation. If we go back to our map of Greece, this is not a perfect map to use. I wonder if I can quickly bring up my regular Greek map. Let me try to do that. I have it usually readily accessible here. And I think it's labeled on here more nicely. Yeah, pretty much. See, if I zoom in over here, this is Salamis. You can see it labeled as a city, so there must have been some settlement there as well. But the island of Salamis is right there. You can see Athens is right there. And this is Salamis. So if the oracle says, oh, divine Salamis, you will destroy the sons of women. And it says, retreat. So, and you're the Athenians, then you're going to retreat from Athens to Salamis, right? And, well, then there's this interesting part of the clue, right? What's this? It's not a wall around Athens. That won't cut it. Theo?
A wall of ships.
Ships are made out of wood, right? And so we've got the fleet. So now we have a nice metaphor here, a wooden wall. So that's what the Athenians did. They withdrew from Athens and they left it vulnerable. The Persians came and they sacked Athens, but the city was deserted. The people had left and the Greek forces had rallied at Salamis. Now, this set up a really interesting scenario. Our other military history map, pardon me, that's not the one. Here we go. For the Battle of Salamis, one of the two great victories of the Greco-Persian War. So here we have Salamis. It's a close-up, right? That evidently is the settlement on the island. And here we have the mainland, and Athens is not on the water exactly. Piraeus here is the port of Athens, and Athens is inland. And Xerxes is here. He is with his army. And he's going to set up his throne to watch the battle. Oops, that's yellow's not so good. I was going to draw Xerxes. There's his throne. Hard to draw a head. There we go. There's Xerxes, and he's at the top of the cliff, sitting on his throne, and watching the battle. Now, this is a very interesting situation. The Greeks have all withdrawn to here. Here we have the massive Persian fleet. What do you notice about this? And as far as a similarity is concerned, to Thermopylae. Once again, right, one side's way bigger than the other. Way more numerous. if the Greeks came out here, what would happen? They'd be completely surrounded. And probably wouldn't be too pretty. But what did they do instead? They stayed here. The Persians came in. Theo?
It's the same because they are making all the Persians clump up. And then they can easily pick them off.
Okay. Try to be closer to your mic. I heard you fairly well, but it might not be picked up on the recording. So, yeah, the point is that they're going to get bunched up. They're going to get all cluttered in that small space. And once again, the Greeks can use their superior quality despite the quantity that the Persians have as their advantage. Now, the one group that the Persians have who are particularly able here are the Phoenicians. These guys, we're going to have reason to mention them again. So I think just for a moment here, it's good to pause and bring up this point that the Phoenicians are here. The Persians are from Persia exclusively, right? And they've got a bunch of other people inside of their empire whom they are controlling and requiring to fight on their behalf. The Phoenicians are particularly important because they are the most able in terms of naval warfare as allies, as subordinate allies of the Phoenicians. So Phoenicia is here. See how it's labeled right here? So this is Phoenicia within the Persian Empire. And it's a coastal, it was a coastal culture. It was a trading culture. And it was a Mediterranean culture. So like the Greeks, the Phoenicians were able seamen. They were able naval in at naval warfare. They were traders, Mediterranean traders, and very capable on the seas. So it's crucial for the Persians to have them as subordinate allies. They had the Egyptians as well, and they had the Phoenicians. And like I said, well, the Phoenicians are going to come back in our story. They didn't ever, when we talked about this part of the history of the world, they didn't really impact it much. It's interesting, one thing that they did, which is a connection that's worth noting, is the Phoenicians were the one that invented our alphabet. So they wrote in an alphabet that was adopted by the Greeks and ultimately the Romans, and those alphabets kind of merged and evolved over time. And the one that we use today was originated by the Phoenicians. And anyway, so they're a neat people. They never really succeeded very well in this particular region, and they were kind of stuck. Their story is kind of stuck inside of the story of other empires and other peoples. And we're going to see them again in the story of Rome. But for now, they are merely a part of the story of the Battle of Salamis. They're the most important enemies. The Greeks have to defeat them in order to win this battle. And so they're going to face them in this really, really constricted space. And this is a really, really crucial victory. Xerxes is watching, right? And he sees his navy defeated. Now he's scared. And his advisors tell him to go back to Persia. They're scared too. And so this was the crucial. The Battle of Salamis is the turning point of the war. Because the Persians have been advancing and advancing and advancing. They have sacked Athens. But now they've lost a major battle. And the fleet has been decimated. And this is a big deal. Because the Persians are not in their homeland, right? They have invaded Greece. They have this moving city. Remember, what's your biggest problem, or at least one of the biggest problems that you have with a really huge army? It's big, it's impressive, but what do you have to do with it that's such trouble? Right? And it's really hard to do. Napoleon had this problem when he tried to invade Russia. Theo?
You gotta feed it.
You have to feed it. Otherwise, all you've got is a moving city, or it won't be moving for long because it's gonna starve. And it won't be much of an army. Right? And for Napoleon, later in European history, he's going to go into Russia with an army of 700,000. It was called the Grande Armée. It was the biggest army ever, probably. And almost all of them died because of the Russian winter. They were not prepared for that environment, and most of them froze to death. This is different. This is them not being prepared, or this is the Persians being afraid of not having access to food, because how are you going to bring the food from Persia? You got a massive empire. That's good. You have a lot of supplies, so but you've got to get them to your army. If you're invading somebody else's homeland, there's two things you can do. You can bring your own supplies, or you can grab the supplies of the people that you're attacking. But usually, the people who are being invaded resist invaders by denying them the supplies. Either withdrawing and taking it all with them, or sometimes the most desperate way of punishing an invader is to use what's called scorched earth tactics, where you literally burn the fields and you destroy the things that the invader wants to take. Of course, it's kind of self-destructive, but it's war, right? And it is your way of hopefully denying the invader the values that he needs and eventually forcing him to withdraw for that reason. Here, the danger for the Persians was by losing their fleet, they're losing their supply line back to Persia. And Xerxes is worried about being cut off by himself from Persia. So he retreats. He takes half the army with him. He's still got the army, and it's still bigger than anything the Greeks have. But he takes half of it with him because he's scared. And then he leaves the other half behind, leading to the Battle of Plataea, the final decisive land battle. Not easy to spell. So, Thermopylae ends in A-E, and Plataea, A-E, and then A again at the end. And this is where the Greeks put together the biggest army that they had ever created. And you can see where it is. It's not that big of a deal. And the military history of it is a little bit too complicated here, I'm trying to label it. There it is. The Battle of Plataea in 479. And they defeated the Persians in this battle. A little bit more of a messy battle, so I'm not going to try to give you the military history part of it. It wasn't like it was some kind of special genius maneuver or anything. So anyway, but they won. It was the Spartans, the Athenians, all the other Greek allies, the biggest army they ever put together, and they were successful. They defeated the Persians. So now we've got these two great victories, and the Persians are on the run. Xerxes has left. The remainder of the Persian army is scattered. They're not a threat anymore. So, what do you do if you're the Greeks? Put yourself in their position. What are your options? Your country's been invaded 3 times. Athens has been sacked. But your enemy is retreating. What do you want to do? What do you vote for, Theo?
Maybe you want to defeat their army and rebuild and build up your military stronger.
Okay, so you're saying it's not enough that they're leaving. You want to go and prevent them from ever coming back. and you want to strengthen yourself so that if they do come back, you'll be able to beat them. Okay, that's one approach, right? That would be trying to learn the lesson of the war and making yourself stronger so that you don't ever suffer like that again. Definitely one good approach. Alternatively, you might say, well, they're gone, and let's rejoice and get back to our lives. If we leave them alone, maybe they'll leave us alone. I mean, the Persians didn't attack the Greeks in the first place. They conquered Lydia, and yeah, they conquered the Ionian colonies. But the war started because the Athenians and the Ionians sacked Sardis. So, and they came now, and they wanted to punish the Athenians and so on, and that's happened. Hey, maybe that's enough. Maybe that's the end of the war. Maybe we don't need to fight anymore. That's another way to look at it. Well, the Athenians, who had suffered the most here, did not just want to sit back. They took Theo's approach, which has the two parts to it, which are really well laid out there. The way Theo's answer had two good parts to it. One was, go defeat them, which is take the fight to them, attack them, and destroy their army. That's pretty ambitious and aggressive, right? But in a way, it's to punish them for their attacks and to further demoralize them and to neutralize them as an enemy. And the other part of it is to strengthen yourself so that you are not susceptible to this kind of attack ever again. And so the Athenians decided to pursue that kind of policy. So in 479, the war didn't really end. It took on a new phase. And the Athenians recruited from among the Greeks to form an alliance, an anti-Persian alliance. And I think I'm going to use this map here to illustrate it. It's a very simplified map, which is good in that regard because it doesn't have a lot of distractions on it. And what you can see is Athens created a new alliance in order to fight Persia. On this map, it's labeled as Athens and its allies. At first, though, and it does change names. So in the Greco-Persian Wars, it's known as the Delian League. Because, and I'm not sure which one of these islands, I can't remember exactly which one it is, but one of these islands here in the center is called Delos. And that was where the treasury of the alliance was kept. So it was kind of like the formal center of the alliance, even though Athens was obviously the dominant power. So Athens formed the Delian League, and after the Battle of Plataea, the Delian League continued to fight the Persian Empire. But, as you can see, there's three different labeled groups on here. On the one hand, we have Sparta and its allies. So remember, when we were doing Spartan history, that's where we ended up. We ended up with the Spartans having restored to various aristocracies and subordinated various peoples, and they've got their alliance. So that's Sparta and its allies. And then we have kind of a separate or third group that are not really committed one way or another. These are labeled on the map as other Greek areas. So they're not really in one alliance or another. But the point of this map is to illustrate the divisions that started to set in at the end of the war. It's kind of sad and it is unfortunate, but it's a very important illustration of a principle that is often misapplied and misunderstood, which I emphasize a lot in History at Our House. And that is that the enemy of my enemy is not my friend. That phrase is not true. The one that people use too often. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's not true. Sparta and Athens were allies. They were temporary allies. They were driven together as allies because they had a common enemy. But that's the only reason they were working together. And if the only reason that you're working together is to fight a common enemy, then you are not friends. Because we don't define our friends on the basis of what we hate in common, of what we oppose in common. A friend is someone who values the same things. We define our friends in terms of what we value in common. So in a sense, you could say, yeah, they were all Greeks. So in some way, yes, the Athenians and the Spartans valued their Greek culture in common. But that was not their primary bond, and we know it, right? What was the primary political identity and patriotism of a Greek was not towards Greece overall. It was for what? Crucial concept of all Greek history, to make sense of it. Theo's got all the answers today. Go ahead.
It's patriotism for their city-state.
The city-state. Exactly. Exactly. So, Athens is a city-state. Sparta is a city-state. They're part of a wider common culture, but that's not their primary association. Their self-identification, just like you probably self-identify as American or whatever applies, right? Most people self-identify in terms of their nationality, as opposed to, let's say, a state identity. Yes, I know some people would say, "Oh, I'm a Texan," or something like that, right? So there are some state-based identities that are pretty strong, but most people, and that's just a feature of American politics and American history, but in most countries, it's the national identity that matters the most. And that's the way that was in Greece as well, because the national identity was more the city-state. So here, one set of these Greek city-states, led by Athens, is pursuing an aggressive policy, and the others are not. And it's the first disagreement that we're starting to see between them, because while Persia was still attacking, they have a common enemy and they're equally afraid of it and they're going to work together. But now that they've defeated that common enemy, the disagreements start to become more obvious. The things that they don't have in common start to become more blatant, more important in their relationships. So now Sparta is going to behave differently. They're not part of this alliance. They're not going to persecute the rest of this war with the Delian League. So if they're not going to do that, we're seeing a divergence here. We're seeing Greece no longer one and unified against Persia, but rather Persia in retreat, Persia now neutralized, no longer really a threat, and Greece divided. So, sadly, that's where we're headed. So when we come back on Monday, we'll look at the aftermath. We'll look at the final few small chapters of this war. It goes on for a while longer because the Delian League is more and more aggressive. And it's going to turn into an Athenian empire. sadly, and that's going to lead to a conflict between the Greeks, sadly. So we got to go from one war to another. All right, well, tomorrow we'll take a break. Again, look at some art. Hopefully, tonight, you can take an even better break and also look at some art. So, good luck. Enjoy that if you can. And we reconvene tomorrow. Thanks, guys. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.